Chapter 60. A few days later, Mr. Ryder presented himself at Gracechurch Street to drink his promised cup of tea. Mary had not imagined that he would act upon his invitation so promptly, but here he was, sitting on Mrs. Gardiner's sofa, sipping her best China tea. He was as tall as Mr. Hayward, but fair-haired where his friend was dark, with a bright-eyed, agile face, and an air of expansive good nature that made him somehow appear to take up a great deal of space in the smartly decorated room. He was completely at his ease, complimenting Mrs. Gardiner on the excellence of her taste and the advantages of a window looking straight onto the street, where every variety of human experience was to be seen passing by.
"Not quite every variety, I hope. This is one of the better parts of the city."
"Oh, yes, ma'am. But who can say what range of emotions may be concealed behind the severe expressions of even our most respectable citizens? The shopkeeper may feel as deeply as the poet, even if his features do not reveal it." Mrs. Gardiner agreed a little reluctantly this might indeed be so, and promised to attend more closely to the physiognomies of her neighbours in future. Mary poured out more tea. "Mr. Hayward tells me that you share his passion for poetry, sir."
"Yes, we learnt to love it together whilst we pored over our law books. I sometimes think it was the only thing that prevented me doing away with myself."
"Really, Mr. Ryder?" exclaimed Mrs. Gardiner.
"Well, perhaps I exaggerate a little."
"Did you find the law so very uncongenial?" asked Mary.
"I'm afraid so. A temperament such as mine isn't suited to the tedium of it."
"I understand your circumstances do not require you to practice some profession," said Mrs. Gardiner.
"I'm very glad to say they do not. I am lucky enough to be master of my own time, and when I see how hard Tom works, I fully appreciate my good fortune. Now, Miss Bennet, I think it is time for me to discover something about you. Hayward says you are a great reader of serious books. Please tell me which are your favourites and why."
He put down his cup, folded his arms, and waited. Mary had not expected to be interrogated and grew a little flustered under his scrutiny.
"But as to my favourites, well, it's hard to say. I shall always hold Mrs. Macaulay in high esteem, Mr. Hume, too, of course, the histories and some of the philosophical works. And I have just begun upon something new, Mr. Godwin's Political Justice. I thought it would be good to read a work written so recently that speaks to our times."
"Are you a radical, then, Miss Bennet? That is a most dangerous and revolutionary book, I believe." Mary turned away, refusing to rise to his teasing manner, and sought diversion amongst the tea things.
"That is its reputation, but it is in fact a very sober, thoughtful work," she said, pouring hot water into the teapot. "It contains some very interesting ideas about how relations between men and women might be improved if a more rational scheme of behaviour was adopted by society in general." Mr. Ryder's air of playful condescension had irked her, but she hoped she had not sounded too pompous in reply. Mr. Ryder, however, did not seem in the least put out.
"I'm afraid Mr. Godwin's book is far too long for me," he replied, holding his cup out for more tea. "I only do well with short works, and I have very little time for philosophies based purely on reason, especially when they attempt to reform relations between the sexes. In affairs between men and women, the only thing that should guide us is the heart."
"I believe that makes you as great an enemy to polite society as Mr. Godwin," declared Mrs. Gardiner. "If there are to be no rules except what we feel at the time, the result will be nothing but anarchy."
"Yes, that is a point of view," said Mr. Ryder genially, nevertheless implying it was not one he shared himself. "But there are many others who would welcome such a change, who would embrace it, as ushering in a long overdue freedom. I am myself in favour of sweeping away the tired old rules that constrain the natural expressions of our souls, and of replacing them with liberty to follow one's inclinations, as and when one wishes."
"I think you will find, Mr. Ryder," interrupted Mrs. Gardiner, "that the liberty in such a situation tends to be enjoyed by the man, whilst the consequences are borne, quite literally in many cases, by the woman. Now, unless we change the subject, I shall have to declare my modesty affronted and ring the bell. Let us talk of something else. With an amused glance at Mary, which she once again refused to return, Mr. Ryder readily agreed, apologizing if he had offended, and declaring himself happy to speak of something else. Mary could not but admire the charm with which he managed the transition, for soon they were safely immersed in conversations of a kind far more proper for the tea-table. From these, Mary and her aunt learnt that Mr. Ryder was indeed a connection of Lady Catherine de Bourgh's, and that it was at Rosings, her house in Kent, that he had first become acquainted with Miss Bingley. He understood now that she and Miss Bennet were related by marriage. Mary did not like to imagine the relish with which she was sure Caroline Bingley had recounted to him the details of the less creditable events in the Bennet family's recent history. But then, she told herself, if Mr. Ryder was such an advocate for following one's passions, perhaps Lydia's elopement would not strike him as so very wrong. The visit went on agreeably enough to the moment when it was appropriate for Mr. Ryder to take his leave. He understood perfectly when this moment was reached, and departed just before it would have been necessary to hint to him that it was time to go. Mrs. Gardiner lay back in her chair and threw her feet onto the sofa opposite her, uttering a great sigh of relief.
"Oh, heaven preserve me from wild young men with dangerous ideas!"
"Do you really think him wild or dangerous?" asked Mary. "I agree his ideas about men and women were somewhat unorthodox, but beyond that he did not seem disagreeable, and Mr. Hayward says he has a good heart."
"His being agreeable and his having a good heart, which I do not deny he may possess, makes him more, not less, of a risk to impressionable young women. And, of course, he is very good-looking, if you don't mind a broader type of build. I cannot say I took much notice of his looks. If that is so, then I am glad to hear it. But I think he noticed yours."
Mary put down her cup, genuinely surprised.
"My looks? What do you mean? There is never anything to notice about me. If that was once the case, it is not so now. You are nicely turned out, all spick and span, and you smile a great deal more than you used to. Some might say there is a positive bloom about you."
Mary was both pleased and embarrassed, and not wishing her aunt to see either emotion, she looked determinedly down at her shoes.
"I don't know what to say. I hope you'll accept it as a compliment, which is what I intended. But..."
Mrs. Gardiner leant forward, her expression serious.
"Do, I beg you, be a little wary of Mr. Ryder. An unworldly girl like you can be very appealing to a young man who fancies himself beyond the rules that govern the rest of us. There may be no harm in him, but do keep a little distance, especially as there is someone of infinitely more value so close at hand."
Mary had resolved some time ago that she would not allow herself to blush again. It seemed such a sign of weakness. But she felt herself redden under her aunt's mild, amused smile. A few seconds of silence ensued, whilst Mrs. Gardiner waited to see if Mary would speak. But when she saw Mary would not do so, she continued briskly on, as though nothing had happened.
"Well, that is the end of my little sermon. But I mean it very kindly, you know."
Chapter 61. For a week, neither Mr. Hayward nor Mr. Ryder appeared at Gracechurch Street. Mr. Hayward was occupied with a particularly onerous piece of business, and let it be known that he must sacrifice the company of his friends until it was completed. Mr. Ryder, on the other hand, was simply out and about, engaged with the small obligations and more numerous pleasures with which he filled his days. Once, to her surprise, Mary met him on one of her regular walks in the city. She had decided to spend the morning exploring St. Paul's Cathedral, and was standing outside it, staring upward at its soaring dome, when she heard his voice beside her.
"Miss Bennet, how delightful to find you here! You are clearly a lover of beautiful buildings, as I am myself."
He joined her and looked up eagerly into the sharp blue sky, where a few white clouds were scudding along in the unseasonably cold wind. Mary was obliged to hold on to her hat and hope that the many pins she had pushed into her hair that morning would keep it in place, for a while at least.
"It is a noble sight, is it not?" he enthused, "and one of which I am particularly fond. When I discovered that none of my friends had visited it, imagine that, Miss Bennet, if you can, I was appalled. Nothing would do but that we rectify such a sad omission with all possible haste. So we leapt into a carriage, and here we are. They will be out presently, and I'm sure you'll be delighted to see them, especially as they are already so well known to you."
Mary's heart sank. It did not take long before her forebodings were realized. Two ladies, also paying close attention to the security of their hats, came striding down the steps that led out of the cathedral, and Mary found herself once again the reluctant recipient of Miss Bingley's and Mrs. Hurst's brittle greetings.
"What a pity we could not join you when we saw you at Vauxhall," began Miss Bingley smoothly. "We had another engagement that evening, so it was impossible, and I fear we had already exhausted the limited enjoyments the gardens have to offer, but your little party looked entirely satisfied."
"I've often observed," agreed Mrs. Hurst, "that it is city people who feel most comfortable at Vauxhall. You all looked very at home there."
"Yes," replied Mary, refusing to rise to their jibes. "We enjoyed it very much."
"I would have expected nothing else," said Miss Bingley.
She turned to Mr. Ryder, who had been surveying the cathedral's great pillared frontage, touching his sleeve lightly with her gloved hand.
"When Mr. Hurst joins us, I think it is time for us to go."
"I don't believe we are in any hurry," Mr. Ryder remarked. "Besides, I am very keen to hear Miss Bennet's thoughts upon this building. Come, do tell us what impressions St. Paul's has awoken in you."
Mary considered. Whatever comment she made would provoke a sneer from Miss Bingley. She supposed she could say nothing at all, or confine herself to the blandest possible observations, hoping not to excite that lady's contempt. But to her surprise, she felt herself disinclined to be cowed. She would say what she thought, and Miss Bingley could make of it what she liked.
"It is undoubtedly magnificent," she began,
"and no one who sees it could fail to be impressed. But I can't help but feel there's something a little cold about it. It's a building more to be admired than loved. I prefer Westminster Abbey. The Abbey is a jumble, grown up over the ages, a positive hodgepodge of styles. But I confess I was moved by it in a way I have not been here, much as I wish to be."
"How unfortunate for poor St. Paul's," murmured Caroline Bingley, "that it has failed to win your approval. I myself found it remarkably fine, but then I do not pretend to be an expert in such things."
She looked sideways at Mr. Ryder, but he seemed not to have heard her, and it was Mary and not Miss Bingley to whom he spoke.
"Yes, I can see that its classical lines would not please everyone, but I'm surprised to find you such an advocate for the Abbey's Gothic charms. I should have thought the severity of St. Paul's would be much more to your taste."
"Once that would have been true, but it really makes no sense to confine one's liking to what one already knows. I'm trying my best to appreciate anything that's pleasing and interesting, wherever it is to be found."
"How very fascinating," declared Miss Bingley. "I hope you will be sure to communicate to all your friends the results of your reflections."
"I could not agree more," enthused Mr. Ryder, ignoring Miss Bingley once more. "We should always acknowledge our appreciation honestly, even when it is inspired by the most unexpected objects."
The wind whipped across the cathedral steps and blew the ribbons securing Miss Bingley's hat in all directions, increasing her mounting impatience.
"Really, where is Mr. Hurst? I had no idea he was so interested in church architecture. He must have found a verger to buy him a pot of beer. Come, sister, we must go and find him or we shall never get on. Good day to you, Miss Bennet."
She gave Mary a curt nod of dismissal and strode away, Mrs. Hurst hurrying along in her wake.
"It would seem I must leave you," exclaimed Mr. Ryder as he hastened after them.
"But I hope to have the pleasure of your company again very soon."
Mary watched them as they hurried back towards St. Paul's, Miss Bingley's irritation obvious in her every angry step. Mary hoped Mr. Hurst had indeed found himself some beer to drink. It might enable him to bear the full force of his sister-in-law's displeasure, which was sure to be soon vented upon him. As she walked briskly back to Gracechurch Street, Mary found herself thinking about Mr. Ryder and his charm. She understood now what Mrs. Gardiner had meant when she warned her against it a few days before. There was something very powerful about a man who paid one such particular attention. It was impossible not to thaw a little when invited, with every appearance of sincerity, to venture an opinion or offer up a thought. She laughed inwardly at this idea. Would such an invitation flatter any woman, or was it only bookish females like herself who would be gratified by it? She supposed a man like Mr. Ryder knew only too well how to please, and could tailor his manner to suit a variety of dispositions. But, making her way down Cheapside, Mary concluded that last thought was ungenerous. It suggested calculation in Mr. Ryder's manner, and the more she considered it, the more Mary was certain that was not the case. She knew she had little experience of the world, but she did not see in him the deliberate flattery of the practiced seducer. No, he was agreeable, not in pursuit of some dark purpose, but simply because that was who he was. His charm was not a weapon to be deployed, but an inescapable element of his character. He liked people to be happy, and it came easily to him to understand how they might be made so. And if that resulted in their looking upon him with indulgence and affection, well, that could hardly be reckoned his fault. Mary could see exactly how such a thing might happen, how quickly one might fall under his spell, and congratulated herself on her immunity to any such risk. Mr. Ryder could never be thought of whilst Mr. Hayward was by. He was Mr. Ryder's superior in every possible way. Miss Bingley, she thought, was welcome to him, for even in the course of a single meeting, it had been evident that Miss Bingley regarded Mr. Ryder as very much her own particular property. Whether this arose from her appreciation of his handsome person and pleasing manner, or resulted from the general knowledge of his being extremely well provided for, Mary could not say. But it was impossible to ignore the avidity with which Caroline Bingley pursued him, much as she had once done Mr. Darcy, finding a thousand occasions to flatter, tease, and cajole him into considering her as a possible wife. Mary supposed Caroline Bingley stood as good a chance of success as anyone. She was elegant, in a glittering, unyielding style, handsome and clever. She was also very disagreeable. But Mary had often observed men did not seem to feel this to be as grave a disability as might have been expected, provided it was accompanied by a pretty face and a decent dowry. Yet for all Miss Bingley's efforts, it did not look as if she had as yet successfully secured her quarry. Mr. Ryder treated her with the same good humour he bestowed upon everyone else. He was unfailingly charming, willing to act as escort, guide, or guest. He smiled obligingly at her milder remarks and seemed not to notice her more astringent asides. But he showed no evidence of any warmer feelings. He did not seem interested in her opinion of St. Paul's, Mary observed. She knew it was an ungenerous thought, but before she dismissed it, she felt a new emotion run through her, a powerful sense of triumph. Today she had been preferred over her enemy, and it pleased her. It was not she who had been snubbed and ignored, but the scheming Miss Bingley. This was not an admirable response, and she suspected none of the great thinkers she had studied would have approved, except, perhaps, Machiavelli, who would have entirely understood why, as she made her way through the now familiar London streets, she carried her head a little higher than usual, a look of amusement lighting up her face. Chapter 62. Mr. Hayward called at Gracechurch Street the following evening. The case that had consumed so much of his time had finally concluded to his advantage, and his mood was jaunty. "The details are tedious, and I will not bore you with them, but suffice to say, I'm pleased with both the result and myself,
as I feel my client could not have had one without the other.
I trust you made him properly aware of his double good fortune?
Asked Mr. Gardiner, who had strolled into the drawing-room to offer both his congratulations and a glass of wine. I'm afraid I did. A barrister in search of briefs cannot afford to be modest. Someone must sing his praises, even if it is only himself.
As they raised their glasses to toast his success, Mary studied Mr. Hayward with covert approval. He was so quick, so witty, so clever, she thought, so much more estimable in every way than Mr. Ryder. There really could be no comparison.
You have been much missed, Tom, announced Mrs. Gardiner. But you must not think we have been solitary in your absence. Your friend, Mr. Ryder, has been on hand to entertain us.
Well, that is his particular gift, and his days are far more his own than mine. He has nothing to pursue but his own pleasure, which brings me quite neatly to the object of my visit. Ryder intends to give a small dinner and has asked me to discover if the three of you might be persuaded to come. He won't embarrass you with an invitation if it would be unwelcome.
Mrs. Gardiner put down her glass, her expression a little wary. Do we know who else will be there?
I think it will be quite a select affair. To be honest, his apartments, whilst they are handsome, are not very large.
I imagine the Hursts and Miss Bingley will be among the other guests.
It is not very fair to put Tom to such a question,
ventured her husband.
He can hardly answer for Ryder's guests.
I think it quite likely that they will be asked, admitted Mr. Hayward. Do you have any objection to them?
I cannot say I find Miss Bingley much to my taste, Mrs. Gardiner replied.
I'm sure we should not be obliged to spend any more time with her than politeness requires, observed Mr. Gardiner soothingly. Come, Mary, what do you say? Shall we oblige Mr. Ryder with our presence?
Mary could see her aunt would have been relieved if Mary had said she preferred not to attend, but she was reluctant to refuse. She was more experienced now in the arts of sociable dining and had come to enjoy her place at the gardener's table, listening happily to the lively conversations and sometimes contributing to them herself. It would be exciting to attend a dinner somewhere other than Gracechurch Street. Why should Miss Bingley's presence deny her that pleasure? It seems rather hard that Mr. Ryder should be refused, because we don't find all his acquaintances agreeable. I am quite prepared to brave Miss Bingley's presence if everyone else is prepared to do so with me.
Very well, I bow to your wishes, replied Mrs. Gardiner. If you can face an evening in Miss Bingley's company, I'm sure I can do the same.
I think you may tell Mr. Ryder that if he sends his invitation, we will be pleased to accept,
said Mr. Gardiner, opening another bottle of the hock. Mr. Hayward lifted up his glass as invited to have it refilled.
I'm very pleased to hear it, but I'm sorry to hear that any friends of Ryder's should be so unmannerly that courage is required to endure their company.
Ah, Tom, declared Mrs. Gardiner, if all of us were perfect, what would we have to talk about? Mr. Gardiner and myself are immune to any darts the lady may choose to send in our direction, and as Mary has declared herself equal to the challenge, I'm sure we will all do very well. Though you must promise, Mary, to come and find me if her teasing becomes unbearable. She will be no match for us both, I can assure you of that.
Chapter 63. When Mary and the gardeners arrived at Mr. Ryder's apartments for dinner, Mary was amused to discover it was situated at very much the right end of Brook Street. There was no danger of his having to endure as a neighbour the fortune-hunting gambler Mr. Hayward had so gleefully conjured up at Vauxhall. Mary was not surprised. Although he liked to declare himself indifferent to the strictest moral conventions, she thought Mr. Ryder unlikely to disobey the rules of fashion. He was sure to prefer a small dwelling at the best address to a mansion elsewhere, and as they were ushered into his rooms, she saw she had been right. Mr. Ryder met them as they entered, exclaiming how pleased he was to see them and showing them every possible attention. The drawing room was not large, but it was gracefully proportioned, with tall first-floor windows and lofty ceilings.
Its furnishings were tasteful but not showy, creating an impression of comfort which pleased Mary very much. Through a pair of open double doors, she glimpsed the shine of a well-polished dining table and the dull shimmer of two fine silver candelabra. Mr. Ryder ushered them towards the warmest part of the room, where a small knot of people were congregated. It was there they discovered Mr. Haywood, already engaged in a lively exchange with two equally animated companions. But on seeing Mary and the gardeners arrive, he hastened over to greet them.
"I cannot say I know many of the guests, but would be pleased to introduce you to these gentlemen, fellow lawyers of my acquaintance. We are discussing the competing merits of the verse of Lord Byron and Mr. Wordsworth." "I suppose we need not ask whose part you take, Tom," said Mr. Gardiner mildly.
"No, indeed, sir," observed one of the eager young men. "Tom has been defending his hero with the greatest possible stoutness."
"Are all you legal men such great lovers of literature, then?" asked Mr. Gardiner. "I had not imagined that to be so."
"We think of little else, sir," declared the second young man. "We must have something to distract us from our work. It is either poetry or the bottle, I'm afraid."
Mary laughed, and Mr. Haywood was about to reply when a great bustle at the door silenced them all. Into the room walked Caroline Bingley, tall, stately, head held high. Her gown was a deep red silk, throwing her white shoulders into stark relief. Garnets shone in her dark hair and at her throat. Mary thought she had never seen anyone look as smart or as terrifying. Mr. Ryder stood at her side, leading her in, almost insignificant beside her. Mr. and Mrs. Hurst followed in Miss Bingley's wake, quite eclipsed by her chilly hauteur. She unbent a little as Mr. Ryder introduced her to some of the other guests. To those she considered her equals, she condescended sufficiently to be almost gracious, but she did not waste much time on cultivating the good opinions of those who did not matter. Instead, with her most engaging smile, she took Mr. Ryder's arm and bore him off, halting before a large portrait which hung above the chimney-piece. Mary, who had not been able to turn her gaze away from Miss Bingley's glittering progress, recognised the portrait subject as Mr. Ryder's relation, Lady Catherine de Bourgh. As the room was not large and Miss Bingley's voice was high and clear, it was impossible to ignore what was said, unless one was conversing with someone else, and as Mary stood somewhat apart from the others, she was able to hear everything that passed.
"My dear Mr. Ryder, I'm so glad you took my advice. Lady Catherine looks magnificent there."
"She does look very imposing. Quite her natural state, one might say."
"The air of dignity about her is only to be expected for a woman of her rank and position."
Mr. Ryder seemed unable to find a reply to this, but Miss Bingley did not seem to mind.
"I should be very happy," she went on in a confiding tone, "to offer any other small suggestions for the arrangement of your rooms. My taste is generally accounted excellent, and nothing would please me more than to put it at your disposal."
Mr. Ryder thanked her for her offer and promised that if the occasion should arise when he was in need of such assistance, he would not hesitate to call upon her. This was enough to please Miss Bingley, who was emboldened to ask if she might take a look at the dinner table before the guests sat down.
"Just cast my eye across it."
Mary had not understood that Miss Bingley and Mr. Ryder were on such intimate terms. Nor, it seemed, had Mr. Ryder, who appeared somewhat nonplussed by Miss Bingley's familiarity. But he followed her obediently as she headed to the dining room. When they returned, a short time later, Mary was careful not to catch Miss Bingley's eye, but it was impossible not to notice the look of satisfaction on her face as she swept past her, which Mary was sure did not bode well for someone amongst their number. It did not take long to discover that it was she herself who was Miss Bingley's victim. When the guests were called to the table, Mary was disappointed to find herself situated far away from all her friends. As he led her to her chair, Mr. Ryder, clearly bemused by her placement, explained that Mary had originally been seated closer to himself and Mr. Haywood, but that Miss Bingley had insisted she would be happiest alongside Mr. Hurst. "She said you did not often have the chance to talk to him," he murmured as he pulled out her chair, "and that you'd be delighted to do so now, Of course, I was pleased to oblige. As she sat down, Mary looked around the quickly filling table. At the other end, too far away for them to speak, sat Mr. Haywood, who looked at Mary quizzically, puzzled by her exile. Between him and Mr. Ryder sat Miss Bingley. When she saw Mary look at her, she returned her gaze with a cool, contented smile before turning to address Mr. Ryder, her hand, Mary noticed, frequently touching his sleeve. At first, Mary's disappointment was acute. The promise of lively conversation had been the principal reason she had wished to come, and there was little chance of that, situated amongst a circle of unremarkable talkers. On one side of her was the husband of a married pair, up from Mr. Ryder's native place in Kent, civil enough, but with none of the bantering wit she had come to enjoy. On the other was Mr. Hurst, who, as yet, had done no more than nod grimly in her direction before pouring himself a large glass of wine. She was about to abandon all hope when she noticed Miss Bingley once again look in her direction, too well-bred to display her victory openly, but too delighted to hide it entirely. Suddenly, Mary felt a flicker of anger. Why should this scheming, vengeful woman enjoy the satisfaction of watching her sit mute while she basked in the company of her two irrepressibly talkative neighbours? Why should she give Miss Bingley that pleasure? She turned to Mr. Hurst with a new determination. There must be some subject in which he was interested. Whatever it was, she would make it her business to discover it. This was partly for her own sake. Mary was resolved that when Miss Bingley next turned to look at her, she would see her, not awkwardly silent, but deep in conversation, but also from pity for Mr. Hurst. It was true his manners did little to recommend him. He was gruff, almost speechless, and drank with a steady application that Mary found alarming. But her sympathies were always roused by those who seemed lonely and disregarded. She remembered how painful it had been to sit at her father's table, longing for someone to be kind to her. She recalled, too, how at Longbourn her simple willingness to listen and take notice had transformed even Mr. Collins into a far more congenial being. All any of us want is a little attention, she thought, as she turned towards Mr. Hurst with a civil, inquiring expression, and set herself to work. Mr. Hurst seemed to have lost the habit of talking for its own sake, and there were many false starts before Mary eventually hit upon the one subject which animated him. When the first course was served, she knew nothing at all about horse racing, but by the time the dessert was cleared, her knowledge had expanded 100-fold. She learned not only the different qualities of horse required to succeed on the flat or over the jumps, but also exactly what was to be looked for when assessing a yearling, and why Newmarket was always to be preferred as a racecourse to York. And she had made a promise never to wager any significant amount on a likely prospect without first taking Mr. Hurst's advice. She could not pretend the experience was as pleasurable as it would have been if she had remained in the place which Mr. Ryder had intended for her, but she acquitted herself well, even though, as Mr. Hurst might have said, the going had been rough at times. By showing a little spirit, she had avoided the misery of staring silently at her plate for the course of the dinner, and had also been able to show a little indulgence to a man not used to receiving such consideration. As the ladies rose to take coffee next door, leaving the gentlemen to their port and brandy, she was pleased with herself, and certainly Mr. Hurst bade her farewell with every appearance of regret. Chapter 64. When Mary entered the drawing-room, she headed straight for her aunt, in whom she longed to confide the story of her dinner-table exertions and the underhand manoeuvres that had made them necessary. But her progress was interrupted by Miss Bingley, who, much to Mary's surprise, took her arm, much as she had done Mr. Ryder's, and led her in the opposite direction. She stopped at the fireplace and sat down upon one of two sofas which faced each other before it. Reluctantly, Mary took a place opposite her.
"I hope you will excuse me leading you away," said Miss Bingley, "but I can't let this evening pass without having had the chance to talk to you properly, a privilege I have not enjoyed for some time."
"Yes, "It was a great pity we were sat at such a distance from each other," replied Mary. "If only we had been nearer, we could have conversed as often as we wished."
"Ah, the mysteries of placement, who can understand them?"
Caroline Bingley's smile dismissed the subject as she gestured expansively at the room around them.
"Tell me, what do you think of Mr. Ryder's apartments? They are very elegant, are they not?"
"They are certainly very well arranged."
"Much of the furniture comes from Rosings. Lady Catherine graciously presented it to Mr. Ryder when he moved here to Brook Street."
Miss Bingley's glance moved caressingly from the small table beside her to an inlaid sideboard standing upon slender legs.
"She is very fond of him, you know."
"That is very fortunate for Mr. Ryder."
"When I was last in her company, Lady Catherine told me she had made your acquaintance when she visited Longbourn."
The room suddenly felt uncomfortably hot. The idea of Miss Bingley and Lady Catherine engaged in conversation about her could only be upsetting. But Mary knew it would be fatal to display any weakness. She took a single, steady breath, imperceptible to anyone but herself, and replied as calmly as possible. "We met when I was staying with Mr. and Mrs. Collins. She paid us a visit one afternoon."
"So I heard. Lady Catherine confessed herself astonished at the great difference between you and your sister. She said you were nowhere near as handsome as Elizabeth, but nor were you so provoking."
"That was very candid of her."
"She is well known for her frankness,"
observed Miss Bingley, turning to Lady Catherine's portrait as if she expected it to confirm what she was about to say.
"In fact, she was extremely interested in you. She thought you had great potential. As a governess."
Mary was horrified. It appalled her to discover that Miss Bingley was privy to the details of that shameful conversation. To give herself some occupation while she considered what to say, Mary reached into a Chinese bowl placed on the table beside her and drew out a few sprigs of dried lavender, clasping them in her hands.
"But unfortunately," continued Miss Bingley, "it seems you left before Lady Catherine could conclude the arrangements. She was most disappointed. She thought it an excellent opportunity for you."
"I was very grateful for Lady Catherine's concern," Mary replied. "But, as I explained to her, I don't think I'm suited to becoming a governess. It isn't the kind of life I should choose for myself."
"You surprise me. It would have made excellent use of all those accomplishments you've worked so hard to acquire. Well, if it isn't to be the schoolroom, you must intend marriage, I suppose."
"I did not say so. Those are your words, not mine."
"But as you have declined to join the ranks of one of the few occupations open to respectable females, it is hard to see what other destiny you have in mind, unless you positively hope to end up as a spinster."
A memory sprang unbidden into Mary's mind of her piano teacher, poor, harassed Miss Allen, hurrying up the drive to Longbourn in her shabby black coat, her music books heavy under her arms.
"Your silence speaks volumes," shot back Miss Bingley. "Let us assume, then, that we must all marry in the end, even clever women like yourself. In that case, perhaps you will allow me to offer you a little advice."
"I think you intend to do so whether I wish it or not."
"It seems to me," began Miss Bingley, "that a great deal of time is thrown away in the pursuit of attachments that can never come to anything. I refer to those where the difference in rank between the gentleman and the lady is simply too wide to be bridged. The most harmonious matches are always those where there is something like an equality of position between the parties involved."
Suddenly, they were interrupted by the sound of loud male voices. The gentlemen had tired of one another's company in the dining room and had come in to join the ladies. Mr. Ryder was first through the door. He waved happily at Mary and then at Miss Bingley, who threw back her shoulders and smiled invitingly at him in return. There could be no doubt of her intentions towards him. Mary looked from Mr. Ryder back to Miss Bingley, poised and superior in her dark red dress. She felt disinclined to be bullied as she had been so often before. "I'm afraid your meaning is a little obscure. I assume you refer to me, but I fail to understand in what connection. As I look about this room, I see no one here but gentlemen, and as I am a gentleman's daughter, I perceive no outrageous distinctions in rank."
"That you choose not to see them does not mean they are not there," retorted Miss Bingley.
"I do not see why that should concern you, unless you believe in some way I do not appreciate, that I am an obstacle to your own matrimonial ambitions."
"I think you know very well to what I refer."
"Do you mean to suggest I am pursuing Mr. Ryder, or that he is pursuing me? If so, I can tell you both accusations are equally without foundation." This time it was Miss Bingley who looked away first. Her hand flew to her hair, which she patted thoughtlessly, before returning to the attack once more.
"Really? And yet it seems you do all you can to please him. I cannot imagine why else he would speak of you as he does. Apparently, you have a cultivated mind and take an interest in the world. You have no false manners or artificial enthusiasms, and there is never anything shallow or affected about you. You must have worked very hard to have left such a favourable impression."
No woman can be entirely unmoved to learn that she has been sincerely praised by a man, especially when she is not used to hearing herself admired, and Mary felt some satisfaction to hear Mr. Ryder's words reported back to her in Miss Bingley's resentful tone. But she did not allow it to alter her reply. "You are quite mistaken in what you imply. Mr. Ryder speaks well of everyone. It is his way. You, who have made such a close study of him, must have seen this for yourself. It does not signify any particular liking for me. He does not mean anything by it." Miss Bingley was unconvinced.
"How, then, is your own behaviour to be understood? You always seem very happy to listen to anything he has to say, and you have certainly smartened yourself up since I saw you last. What is the reason for that, if not to improve your prospects in one way or another?"
Mary was suddenly so angry that she did not trust herself to speak, and in those few seconds, Miss Bingley recovered much of the self-possession which had briefly deserted her.
"Confine yourself to your proper sphere, Miss Bennet. Do not trespass where you cannot hope to succeed. Do not embarrass yourself and your friends by pursuing an attachment which cannot be returned. Presumption of that kind leads only to disappointment and humiliation where matters of the heart are concerned."
Mary had promised herself she would not allow Caroline Bingley to provoke her, that she would not sink to exchanging insults, but she could contain herself no longer. When Mr. Darcy had so obviously rejected Miss Bingley's advances in favour of Lizzie, Mary had felt some sympathy for her. She did not think her amiable, but she had been sorry for her humiliation. But now any sense of pity was utterly extinguished. "You seem to know a great deal about rejection. Is this a lesson you have learnt from extensive study, or do you perhaps owe it to experience of a more personal nature?" Miss Bingley flinched. She had not expected Mary to land such a blow. Her outrage was unmistakable. Mary thought she might have struck her if such behaviour had been permitted in polite drawing rooms, but instead Miss Bingley drew her silk skirt around her as if to protect her from further insult.
"I speak only from what I have observed. It is a truth universally acknowledged, I believe."
With a contemptuous nod, Miss Bingley rose and strode quickly away, over to where Mr. Ryder and the other gentlemen stood. Mary watched as she moved as close to Mr. Ryder as she dared, and began to practice upon him all the little flirtatious teases with which she had once sought to attract Mr. Darcy. Even from across the room, Mary could sense the archness in Caroline Bingley's tone, could imagine the playful scolding with which Mr. Ryder was charmingly rebuked, and could almost feel the repeated light touch of her fan on his arm, a gesture so suggestive of her possessive intent that Miss Bingley might as well have shouted out her intentions to the entire room. Mary remained on the sofa, disturbed by the vehemence of the encounter. The lavender stems were still in her hands, and she rubbed them together more until they released their strong, pure scent, which she breathed in deeply to calm herself. She could not believe what had just happened. It was scarcely to be credited that Miss Bingley should consider her, of all people, a rival for Mr. Ryder's attentions, and it was even more to be wondered at that she had not meekly absorbed the insults with which Miss Bingley accompanied her accusations. She had fought back, and with some asperity, too. Had she been too cruel? She considered the question seriously for a moment, before recalling the numerous petty humiliations to which Miss Bingley had subjected her, the many small indignities she had suffered at that lady's hands. No, she did not think so. She tucked the lavender sprigs into the sash of her dress, rose from the sofa quite calmly, and went to find her aunt and uncle, entirely satisfied with her conduct. Chapter 65. Mary discovered Mr. and Mrs. Gardiner seated comfortably in the quieter part of the room, in conversation with a couple from Kent. Her aunt beckoned her to sit beside them, and as soon as politeness allowed it, took her niece to one side and, in a low whisper, asked what had occurred between herself and Miss Bingley.
"I saw you speaking to her just now," she began, "and I was quite concerned. I hope she was behaving herself."
"Oh, she was much as she always is," said Mary. "There were a few matters she wished to discuss with me."
"Really?" replied Mrs. Gardiner. "That seems most unlike her. She's never shown any desire to speak to us before."
She looked at her niece questioningly. Mary was unsure how much of Miss Bingley's conversation she should reveal. Part of her was tempted to confide in her aunt, as there was no one she trusted more. But she knew any confession would result in adverse consequences. Mrs. Gardiner was already wary of Mr. Ryder and what she regarded as his excessively free and plausible manner. If Mary were to tell her about Miss Bingley's jealousy, that would only add to her aunt's prejudice against him, for his being admired by a woman she disliked was not calculated to improve her opinion of him. She supposed Mrs. Gardiner might even discourage him from visiting Gracechurch Street, and when Mary contemplated that prospect, she was honest enough to acknowledge she did not welcome it. If Mr. Ryder were no longer to call at Gracechurch Street, there was no doubt that Miss Bingley would consider that a great victory. She would tell herself that for all Mary's bluster, she had quickly capitulated to Miss Bingley's will and had obediently forbidden Mr. Ryder her company. Mary's expression hardened as she imagined the pleasure this would afford Miss Bingley, and decided this was not a satisfaction she was prepared to grant her. She would say nothing to her aunt that might result in Mr. Ryder's exclusion, and would instead do all she could to ensure he came just as often as before. Mary was honest enough to admit that her reluctance to see less of Mr. Ryder did not arise solely from her desire to disoblige Miss Bingley. He was a very entertaining visitor. Amusing, lively, intriguing even. His frank declarations, which had so provoked her aunt, were exciting to her. She had never met anyone quite like him before, so confident in his own opinions and so untroubled by the criticisms of others. There was something refreshing in the uncomplicated sunniness of his character, which turned effortlessly away from any difficulty, gravitating instead to what was pleasurable and, of course, gratifying to himself. She hastened to remind herself that he had none of Mr. Hayward's finer qualities, but it could not be denied that Mr. Ryder was naturally happy, and Mary had discovered it improved her state of mind to be amongst happy people. For that reason alone, she would have been sad to see him no more at Gracechurch Street. All these considerations confirmed her resolve to keep to herself what had passed between her and Miss Bingley, and she managed a tolerably cheerful smile as she replied, "Oh, it was really nothing. Nothing that bears repeating, anyway." Mrs. Gardiner did not appear entirely convinced, but before she could interrogate Mary further, Mr. Ryder himself appeared before them, eager to hear that supper had been to their liking. Both exclaimed that they had enjoyed it very much, although Mrs. Gardiner regretted Mary had been placed so oddly. "I was very well where I was," answered Mary quickly. It had appeared as though Mr. Ryder had been about to offer an explanation for how her exile had come about, and she had no wish for her aunt to discover Miss Bingley's stratagems.
"As I was denied the pleasure of conversing with you tonight," said Mr. Ryder, "I hope I may be allowed to make up for my loss by calling on you tomorrow."
He looked inquiringly at Mrs. Gardiner. "Might that be convenient?" From across the room, Mary glimpsed Miss Bingley watching them closely, and decided to deflect any possibility of refusal.
"I'm sure we should very much like to see you, should we not, Aunt?"
"Of course," said Mrs. Gardiner. "We shall be glad to offer you tea, Mr. Ryder, as long as there is no more talk of unregulated passions."
"I promise to say nothing at all about passions, ma'am, regulated or otherwise."
Mrs. Gardiner watched him coolly as he walked away.
"I'm not sure why you were so keen to have that young man at the house again."
"It seemed the polite thing to do. He invited us here, after all."
"I suppose you are right," replied Mrs. Gardiner uncertainly. "But he is a little pert for my tastes."
Her face suddenly broke into a smile. Mary turned and saw Mr. Hayward was approaching them, carrying two glasses of wine, which he presented to them before settling himself on the sofa opposite.
"Ah, Tom," declared Mrs. Gardiner with a glance at Mary, "you are always welcome at Gracechurch Street for breakfast, dinner, or even children's tea, if you think you have the courage to attempt it."
"If there was bread and butter on offer, it should hold no fear for me, especially if there was greengage jam. We never get that at my lodgings."
"Oh, the sorrows of the single man," lamented Mrs. Gardiner. "When you change your situation, you may demand from your wife whatever jam you wish for. That's a husband's privilege, you know."
"One I eagerly look forward to exercising at such future time. What is your opinion, Miss Bennet? You're sure to have one, even upon jam."
"It is raspberry for me," Mary declared. "Or, if that's not to be had, I may console myself with strawberry. But I venture no further into the exotic."
"I'm sorry to hear it," he said. "So, even if we were married, I could not obtain the wish of my heart. Greengage jam at breakfast."
Mary smiled. The idea of them as husband and wife, eating greengage jam together, affected her so powerfully that to give herself something else to think about, she plucked the bunch of lavender from her sash and began to rub the sprigs between her fingers.
"Where did you find that?" asked Mr. Hayward.
"I took them from a bowl over there," Mary replied. "I hope that does not make me a thief."
"Well, possession is always said to be 9/10 of the law."
He moved towards her.
"It smells very good. May I have a piece?"
Mary held out a sprig to him. He took it and stuck it in the buttonhole of his jacket.
"Your friend, Mr. Ryder, has invited himself to Gracechurch Street tomorrow," said Mrs. Gardiner. "I suppose I could not convince you to come too."
He looked genuinely disappointed.
"I should like that of all things, but it's impossible. I have so much business at present that I cannot get away. I am very sorry for it."
"That's a great pity. Mr. Ryder cannot really take your place. We miss you, Tom, don't we, Mary?"
"Yes," agreed Mary quietly. "We do indeed." Not long afterwards, Mr. Ryder's supper reached that point, never publicly declared but always privately understood, when everyone knew it was time to go. Soon Mary stood in the hallway, waiting while her aunt and uncle made their farewells to their host. Mr. Hayward appeared with her coat, which he had undertaken to retrieve for her.
"I hope Ryder is not becoming a trial to you and Mrs. Gardiner," he said as he helped her into it. "He takes up people he likes with great enthusiasm, but he does not always know when he has outstayed his welcome. I'm sure I could suggest he lengthen the intervals between his visits somewhat."
"Oh, I don't think that will be necessary," replied Mary, her mind still upon thwarting Miss Bingley. "He is really no trouble, and I should not like to hurt his feelings."
"I see," he replied, somewhat taken aback. "Of course, I shan't speak to him unless you wish it."
Mary saw instantly that he had misunderstood her meaning. She had not meant to imply that she could not bear to surrender a moment of Mr. Ryder's company, but that was clearly what Mr. Hayward thought he had heard. She was about to attempt to correct such an unfortunate impression, but before she could do so, she was surprised to hear her own name pronounced, quite loudly, at the bottom of the stairs. At first, she did not recognize the voice. Then she saw Mr. Hurst and his wife standing at the front door below, and she realized it was he who was speaking. His wife's words were said too low to be audible, but her husband's were only too easily discerned.
"You and your sister may say what you please, but in my opinion that Bennet girl is much improved. It was a pleasure to sit next to her."
His wife's response could not be heard, but to Mary's increasing distress, Mr. Hurst replied with even greater volume.
"Well, she didn't look plain to me. Perfectly tolerable, in my opinion. You can see Ryder's interested. If I were him, I'd snap her up before some other fellow does."
To Mary's intense relief, they heard no more, as Mr. Hurst was bustled into the carriage and carried away. In the silence that followed, Mr. Hayward stepped towards her, horrified. "Miss Bennet, I must apologize. I should have called out. I should have told him he could be heard. I was too slow." "I'm sure he didn't mean it. He drank a lot of wine at dinner."
"I'm very sorry you had to hear such things," said Mr. Hayward angrily. "I should have prevented it."
"Really, it was not your fault. Mr. Hurst is not a very sensible man. Who can say what he might come out with?" Suddenly she was very tired and could not think clearly. First Miss Bingley and now this. She began to feel overwhelmed. "I think I should like to go now. If you would take me to my uncle and aunt's carriage, I'll wait for them there. And please, Mr. Hayward, don't tell them what just happened." Tom Hayward took her arm and led her forward. Neither of them mentioned Mr. Ryder as they walked out into the darkness, but Mary thought Mr. Hayward had a preoccupied look, as though an idea had occurred to him that he did not much care for, and he was turning over in his mind what he should do about it. He handed her into the carriage and bid her a polite good night. She threw herself back against the seat and closed her eyes. If it was as painful as this to live a life of feeling, then perhaps cold rationality had a great deal to recommend it.